You're listening to Conspiracy Theories, Special Edition with Spencer Bennett. Now back to the show.
And we're back with Conspiracy Theories. I'm your host, Spencer Bennett. Our special guest today, Tom Horn from Reuters News and best-selling author of The Aramont Gate. We've got a festival going on this next weekend in Roswell, New Mexico, commemorating, I guess, the 59th anniversary of something that could have happened there and probably did happen there back in 1947. But I'm kind of curious, before we get into that, tell me how you got interested in UFOs and these subjects.
Well, it's really a kind of a strange story. I mean, when I was a kid, my dad was a police officer. He'd come home from the Korean War and got a job in the small Arizona town of El Mirage, Arizona, which is just west of Sun City, or used to be. Sun City's grown so much it's actually grown around it, but just right there next to the Agua Fria River. And Dad came home, got this job as a cop. Dad had also grown up in the Arizona desert, riding fence lines for the Bard Ranch, which was one of the largest open range ranches at the time. And he loved to hunt, knew the desert like the back of his hand. So he decided to go mule deer hunting one day, and he went up in the mountains. And I'm going to make this story as short as I possibly can. He went up in the mountains and come around a corner, and lo and behold, here are these very large spherical holes that went down into the ground.
Now, I'm not talking about sinkholes.
We're not. No. These were about 20 feet across, maybe 8 to 10 feet deep, and they were perfectly cylindrical. By the way, I could even email you a picture of these.
Oh, that would be great.
My dad took pictures of them. He'd never seen anything like them before, and he'd been, you know, he was a construction man. He'd been in the military. He was friends. He'd been around a long time. He'd seen everything in the desert. He'd never seen anything like these, and in fact, the way they were made, whatever made them, was described to me as possibly using some kind of intense heat mechanism. And the reason is because even if they had been cut into the ground with the world's largest diamond bit tipped drill bit, they would have left etchings and markings along the sides of the walls. But these were almost polished.
You know what that sounds like? That sounds like that article that you had on your website too, of the Dropa caves. That were very similar.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, but these things were so perfect. You know, I grew up in the desert too, so I know what it's like out there. I know how fast water will evaporate. These things were so perfect that the walls weren't cracked anywhere because they were plumb full of rainwater.
Wow.
And all of them were. And there's deer. In fact, the one I'm actually sitting right here right now looking at a picture, and I can count four full-sized deer, a big buck with a big set of racks floating in this, because these deer would come down, drink out of these holes, but they'd slip in them and fall into them, and then they couldn't get out. Well, anyway, Dad had never seen anything like them, so he took pictures. He came back to the police department. He called the Corps of Engineers, talked to a friend of his, the Army Corps of Engineers, took him up there, showed them to him. That guy was absolutely flabbergasted, never seen anything like it before. They talked to the local Indians that lived in the area, and they determined that these things had to have appeared almost overnight, because the Indians weren't even aware of them being there. In this mountain area, these huge holes, there was no debris. They hadn't been dug out. The debris had been essentially vaporized. There was nothing next to them, piled up beside them, or anything to show where the debris had been taken out. So this was not any kind of mining operation or anything. So the Corps of Engineers went up, studied them, could not determine where they came from. The Phoenix Gazette, the largest newspaper in the state of Arizona, went up, took pictures of my dad kneeling, squatting down beside him with his 30-odd six deer rifle, and ran an article in the Phoenix Gazette called Mysterious Mountain Holes, in which they invited anybody who could explain what these things were to come forward and tell them what they were. The bottom line is, the short story is, they never found out. They never determined what they were.
Wow.
The animal rights people were concerned with it, so the Corps of Engineers went up and dynamited them full of rock so that the animals would quit falling into them and dying. And that,
what's wrong with building a fence?
Well, you know, in retrospect,
right?
This was back in the day where, you know, you'd send a powder monkey up there and blow stuff up.
That's obviously more fun than building a fence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But now I don't know if there's a connection to this or not. But on November 5th, 1975, sometime later, along the northeastern ridge of that Arizona mountain range, a guy by the name of Travis Walton stepped out of his pickup to look at what he called a glowing object. And according to his report, while a crew of loggers were waiting nearby that had come there with him, he walked up to this, what he called a UFO, and he said he was jolted by a blast of inexplicable energy. His companions freaked out, jumped in their vehicle, and took off. His story was made into a book first and then into a movie called Fire in the Sky. It was considered to be the best documented account of a UFO abduction ever recorded. Now, I don't know if Travis Walton's story is true. I've asked Stanton Friedman about it, and Friedman has had Walton in his house a few times, and he said that he comes across as being believable. So I don't know, and I also don't know if there was a connection between the Walton UFO event and my dad's discovery in that same area. But what I do know is that very soon after that discovery, literally within a couple of weeks, I was, myself, my brother, my dad, my mom, we were shaken out of bed at about maybe 2 o'clock in the morning with my 13-year-old sister screaming, and I got to tell you, with a sound that you never want to hear a person, you never want to hear this, and we ran to her bedroom, and she's sitting up in bed, she's got this almost like a hypnotic look, like she's coming out of a nightmare or something, in her eyes, wide open, like silver dollars, and literally like something out of a Spielberg movie. Mm-hmm. And Mom jumped in bed with her. My dad took me and my brother and took us in the other room, made us stay in there. I remember trying almost the impossible, and that was to go back to sleep after that event. But now, as a kid, my parents would never share any of the details of that story with me. Sometime later, you know, I pastored for 25 years, also was involved as an exorcist. My brother pastored, began pastoring some 5 or 6 years after I had first started. He's still a pastor in the Tucson, Arizona area. And so this whole thing was simply not part of our world view. And yet there were elements of it that that bothered me, because as a kid, you know, we never thought about these kind of things. But over time, I started noticing other people experiencing similar events. And so I went to my sister first, and I asked her, what happened that night? Now, this is the story I'm telling you now is maybe 30 years ago. I went to her, and I said, what happened that night? And she tells me this story, and my mother confirmed this story, that she had woke up in the middle of the night, and there were these small, bulbous-headed men, small men, gray men, standing around her bed, 3 or 4 feet tall. And they terrified her, and she didn't know what was going on. I also found out from my sister that that event continued to happen throughout her lifetime. My sister has more physical disabilities. She has so many physical disabilities. At one time when I was providing my family's medical history to a Harvard doctor, he didn't believe it. He said, there's no person on the earth that could have this many things wrong with them. And I had to provide the medical records to him to substantiate that fact. But so that began happening. Now, the problem with all of that was it didn't fit into our worldview at all. It was not something that I was comfortable with. But when I was a pastor, I kept seeing people around the world talking about things that I knew as a family we had covered up. Something that had been happening to my sister. Now, here's an element that is ultimately important about this. The first night that that happened, my mother jumped in the bed with my my sister. She put a Bible under her pillow. She began praying over her. And that event ceased happening for some period of time. My sister tells me this story, how that over some period of time, she began doing what a lot of us do. You know, she goes out and starts sowing her wild oats and goes crazy, goes wild, starts, you know, messing around with all kinds of guys, stuff like that, the event starts happening again. The strange thing about that is that she was able to verify to me on so many occasions how that same pattern repeated, that's what caused me to think that there was a spiritual dynamic in what we were talking about here. And yet, as a pastor, I started dealing with people, trying to help people, and I started seeing this event taking place in a few other people that I came to know. I was pastor of a very large church that I won't mention, but we were connected to Trinity Broadcasting Network and some others, and we actually hosted their West Coast broadcast, became very connected, so this was obviously not a skeleton that I wanted to drag out of the closet in front of these people who would have thought that I was, you know, that my family were a bunch of fruitcakes. But I did care about the people with which this was happening. And then about 10 or 12 years ago, my sister's daughter, my niece, started having the same experiences. She is a federal employee with the Social Security Division, and she went to the head psych doctor, by the way, at the Social Security Division. Not only did he say she was not crazy, he said that the event was real and that the government was aware of it and that they actually had studied it in some of the conferences that he had been at. And then her daughter has also started having these same events. And then, and this is where this almost becomes...
generational.
Well, almost. It's where it almost becomes something like a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because here just maybe 4 years ago now, my niece was in Seattle, Washington. She went up there to see a football game, and she was standing outside of the Space Needle with a group of friends that came with her, four or five people, and her husband. And all of a sudden, right out of the crowd comes these two people that are dressed in military clothing, a man and a woman, and they walked right up to her, and they said, "Come with us. You have been chosen." And my niece, she's not going to go with them, obviously, because she doesn't know who they were. And then they explained it to her that they were working with Steven Spielberg, and that Spielberg had set up a makeshift building across the road from the Space Needle where he was promoting his Taken television series that was getting ready to be broadcast on television at the time. And they said to her, "If you come with us, you know, we'll give these promotional items, things like that. We're promoting the TV series." So then all of a sudden she got excited about it. She went with them over. They gave her a pass, a little security pass, that helped her to get through a particular door. She went inside. There's this very large group of people inside that had been selected by a lot of people. And the first thing they do is they put them through a psychological evaluation, asking them all of these very strange questions about their dreams and what they dream about and what happens in their dreams and all these other questions. And at the end of the psychological evaluation, my niece and one other person from this large group of people was selected as, in Spielberg's opinion, being two people who probably had been experiencers, taken, abductees. And so they separated them from all of the other crowd and took them to another place where they were allowed to see Spielberg's private collection of what he called alien implants.
Really?
Yes. And but it gets weirder than that. And there's so many stages to this. She leaves that event. She comes home. Her husband tells me that he came home one day. Here she is. She's standing in the doorway, blood running down over her face. She's got this huge gash on the top of her head, and she's pointing out the backsliding screen door, and she's saying, "There, look, there it is." And he turns around. He says he thought he saw a guy in a zoot suit ducking underneath some brushes and running away. Well, he thinks that she's been assaulted.
Right.
By a robber or something, and so he calls 911. They get an ambulance to take her to the hospital. While she's at the hospital, her blood toxicity comes back enormous, and off the charts with her blood being poisoned somehow. And so my brother, by the way, went by there and prayed with her. But there was these other people that came in the room. And this woman comes in the room that's dressed in military garb again, and she looks down at her and she says, "It's not what you are now, but it's what they will make you." And then she leaves.
Creepy.
Very creepy, very strange. I mean, all of this, the fact that any of that with them could be coincidental was just incredibly strange.
That's amazing.
But she also told me this. She said that the guy that ran away was not a zoot suit. She said he looked like a praying mantis. She said, "I don't even know what happened." She said, "I was at home. The next thing I know, I'm standing by the back door. There's this thing that looks like a praying mantis, a man mantis, and it's going away, you know, like a reptoid alien, and it's going away." So, very strange story, not anything that I can even, frankly, can't even adapt into my idea about the world and the cosmology that I believe in or anything like that. But just a few nights after that, she's home, she's on the radio. A few weeks after that, she's home, she's on her computer. I'm a very low-tech guy, so I can't explain how any of this works, but you'll understand it. She's on the computer, she's talking to her friend, she's got this little camera that snaps a picture every few seconds so that her friends on the other side can see her face.
Mm-hmm.
So she's doing this, she's chatting. But this program also puts a small picture down in the right-hand corner of her monitor so that she can see herself as well as she can see them.
Right, neat little webcam.
Okay, so it's a little webcam thing. I don't know nothing about that. But it's every few seconds it's snapping a picture. But once, by the time she sees the picture is a second or two late. So it's snapping these pictures, everything's fine. All of a sudden, this picture pops up on the computer screen, and here is this being, a three-dimensional being, that looks very much like your standard alien gray, and it's standing right behind her, looking right at her.
Well, that'll freak you out.
Well, it did freak her out, and she called me, and I can tell you, I remember she was panicked out of her mind. She sent me this picture. I can send you a copy of the picture.
I would love to see it.
And so this thing pops up on the screen. She has no idea what it is, but it's this. There's this being. It's only half inside the screen, but this huge praying mantis-like eye that's looking at her. Half of the body, the shoulders, the arm, it's all very easily detectable standing there. She spins around because the image is taken a second or two before she sees it. She spins around. There's nothing there. So she sends a photo over to me. I sent the photo over to Steve Quayle, asking him what he thought about it. Then I sent it over to Stan Deo. Both of these guys are friends of mine. And Stan, you know, is a photo analyst, an expert, who's done work, for, in fact, he's held above top secret security clearance with the Pentagon, things like that. So he does the photo analysis for me. And his finding is, first of all, number one, that the photo is not a fake, that there is really something there. And secondly, his idea about the photo is that maybe, and he takes a very conservative approach to this, that maybe it is light reflecting off of something else and captured in this this camera, creating what appears to be a three-dimensional form. That's the way he explained it to me. Mm-hmm. So I took the photo, I sent it over to a friend of mine, and also Stan's photo analysis, which was more than one picture. It was a whole blanket of pictures and his whole analysis and all everything that he wrote. I sent it to a friend of mine, Scott Top Clarence, and asked him what he thought, and he said, okay, yeah, I can accept that. But he said, ask Stan if he's familiar with a particular science model that says that multidimensionals might be able to use a method of light manipulation, photon manipulation, to overlay light manipulation around a kind of a three-dimensional membrane to make for themselves a holographic image. Anyway, he explained it in terms of science. I sent it over to him, and Stan was very familiar with that. Now, I was on the Coast to Coast radio program with George Norrie recently, and I happened to bring this up talking to George, and George asked me for the photo, so I put it on a page where George and the people at Coast to Coast could look at. Mm-hmm. And there happened to be two guys, one a theoretical physicist and another guy who was a photo analyst for the military, that were listening to the show. They both went there, downloaded the photo, put it into their computers, did a complete analysis of the photo. Both of them sent me their emails. One of them said, it's absolutely a three-dimensional character. It is not light reflecting off of anything else. It's actually a three-dimensional manifestation. It's real and the photo is not a fake. But the other guy went even further and analyzing the photo, and he said, you can actually even see reflections from the computer screen in the eye.
Oh my gosh.
Of the being. And he actually even detected the fingers on this thing. But it was there 1 second, it was gone the next. So anyway, the bottom line is that's a very... So when you ask me the question, Tom, why are you, as a conservative Christian and even politically conservative, why are you talking about this crazy stuff? It's because I grew up in a family where something was happening. I never seen it myself. I don't ever want to see it, by the way. I don't want to experience it at all. But I know my sister, and I know my niece, and I know these are honest people, and they've never publicized this. They've never made it a public issue. They've never talked about it. I'm the only guy that's ever talked about this. It's been in the family closet my whole life. But because I've wanted to understand that, as well as how that story seems to be echoed around the world with other people, and how it also seemed to be redundantly reported in the history and mythos of cultures around the world. Mm-hmm. It was just something to me that I realized after a period of time, I guess like a court of law would do, when you've seen too many eyewitnesses and too much redundant reporting of the same empirical evidence, that after a while you start thinking, okay, I may not be able to say what this is, but it's real.
We'll be back with more Conspiracy Theories Special Edition right after this.